This is Margaret Cho, and you're listening to The Bicast, podcasting for the bisexual community.
You put the B in LGBT. You put the B in LGBT.
Welcome to the Bicast, podcasting for the bisexual plus community. I'm Elizabeth Meacham, and I'm here with Faith Cheltenham, who is again speaking with Dr. Changela Roberts, professor of psychology at Western Michigan University. They'll be speaking about the intersectionality of sociology, psychology, and black bisexual lives. Welcome back, Dr. Changela, and take it away, Faith.
Absolutely. You know, when I say intersectionality of black bisexual lives and sociology and psychology, you know, I'm speaking about intersectionality as a black woman, right?
Yeah.
With a black woman, right? And thanks again to Elizabeth for hosting space for us to have a conversation. But I think it's one of these places where a lot of times there's four conversations one could have, and sometimes there's the conversation that people are getting in the media about, or on Facebook, let's say, about what it is to be a black doctor, black female doctor, and look really cute and have just everything, you know, well positioned in the graduation photo. And the subsequent reality of experience as a black female professional, mm-hmm. right? And then the dissonance between those two realities. And then your work explicitly, you know, has delved into deeply that dissonance and the realities that people face as humans and, you know, of varying minority backgrounds.
Definitely, yeah.
So, you know, it's all to say, like, how bad is it? Not sure.
I figured that's where you were going.
Keeping in mind that, like, you know, we want you to keep your job. Keep your job. But that's why I always say keep your job until you don't want your job. And let me know if you want your job. But in the meantime, we're going to keep your job. You know, I'm interested just to wonder about that transition, right? Because the last time we spoke, you were on this path. And now you've achieved, you know. So let's start there, right? Like, how is it at Western Michigan, and how long you been there? What are you loving? What are you doing? Are you teaching? Are you are you researching, et cetera?
Okay, great. All of the things. So at Western, I'm teaching and researching in the counseling psychology department, which is the field that I got my degree in, and it's been great, honestly. It's
nice.
It's been really great. I just started here this academic year, so I just started in August, so I am about to end my first full year, second semester. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I really feel fortunate to be in a department that focuses a lot on racial diversity. Like, that's just stated in all of our materials and the way that classes are taught, the way that classes are expected to be taught in faculty research. That's just stated in there. So I was really happy about that coming in, knowing that I wouldn't be the only black face or the only person talking about race, right?
Mm-hmm.
The position that I have is specifically for me to do LGBT research.
That's great.
I know. I know.
I was like, excuse me? Okay. I was like, Tumblr, say what? Say what?
Exactly. Like, I didn't know that was a
I was
a
like, are you the first black LGBT, or you're probably one of the only black LGBT people to have funding to study LGBT people who might be, are you studying also people of color or LGBT?
Yeah, so it's sort of, since our department's focused on race, it's like expected, sort of like a unspoken expectation that my research is going to be on queer people of color, which I'm happy about that because that's what I do. That's what I like to do. So that's been great.
That's fantastic. And for everybody who's listening who doesn't know, I just looked it up. Western Michigan University is located in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and it's a public research university. It's founded in 1903.
Yes, it is. In the nice little Kalamazoo.
All right. So you're in an affirming, good, diverse space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Kalamazoo is diverse too.
Kalamazoo is pretty diverse. So I'm actually living in Grand Rapids and commuting to Kalamazoo. So it's a bit of a commute.
Wow.
My partner moved here with me in Michigan, and they got a position at another university. And so we sort of pulled straws and made a decision who was going to make that commute. So I'm perfectly fine with that. But Kalamazoo is I'd say relatively diverse comparing to some of the surrounding areas, but the department is definitely, I mean, when I say diverse for the department, there's 7 faculty members and 4 of us are African-American.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. The other three are white.
Mm-hmm. And this is coming from, like, my experience in grad school where I never had a black professor in my entire grad school.
Mm-hmm. And Western Michigan has some black history, right?
Yes. I'm learning a lot about the black history in the area. So something I just recently learned was that there's some smaller communities in and around around the Kalamazoo area that were really influential for the Underground Railroad sites.
Mm-hmm. And then you also, I think, have, looks like, Idlewild.
Idlewild is a really fun place. It's great. It was the only, I believe, or one of the first, all-black resorts. So black-owned, black entertainment, and people would make the drive from the South and from other areas up to Idlewild, Michigan, just to have this summer resort experience where they could be around black people and just live in, you know, old time black fun. And it's just amazing that it's there.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks like the National Historic Trust is having conversations about it. We'll make sure a link on our blog to more information about the visits that you can make to Idlewild, which is still there. It's also the home of Joe Louis and Dr. Daniel Hale Williams, America's first open heart surgeon. Wouldn't be a Black History Month podcast or Black Bisexual History Month podcast without a mention of the first that black people did, because I always tell people it was like super important.
Of course.
To be like, yo, a lot of it has to do with, as you know, we listened to yesterday from Mr. David Johns, you know, ingenuity that comes from adversity, which I think by people of every, you know, hue and shade can understand and relate to. So tell me more about, so your research, you said, is, you know, getting to research LGBT people of color, and then you said, are you also seeing patients and stuff as a clinician?
So I'm not right now. I'm hopefully sometime in the relative future, I'm going to get my license to practice. So hopefully I'll be a licensed psychologist pretty soon. So I'm not seeing clients right now, but it's fun and interesting being on the other side of training counselors, future counselors who are potentially going to have their first clients in a semester or in a year.
That must be really, especially because, I mean, it's been a bit of a process for you, right?
It's a process. I mean, even if you're going to be a master's level clinician, you're still looking at 2 to 3 years of graduate school plus getting all of this practical experience before you can take a test to get licensed and then practice on your own. So it's a process.
Mhm. Mhm. Well, that's so good though, because there's not as many people of color, you know, clinicians, LGBT people of color clinicians, you know, in the least. I don't know if you're aware of the Queer Therapist Network?
Yeah.
The Queer Therapist of Color Network, right?
Yes, yeah, that's a great resource. It really is.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good resource if you're looking for support and you're an LGBTQIA, SGL, Two-Spirit, unlabeled, no boxes, individual. It exists out there for people to find support and find help. There's also BiZone, which has a bisexually aware therapist's kind of website listing. And then I've also found to be really helpful the Kink Aware Therapist list.
Hmm.
Yeah, from, I think it's the National Alliance for Sexual Freedom,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Yeah, and I'd also say Therapy for Black Girls has been mm-hmm. a really great resource for...
that's a Facebook group, right? Or a Facebook page?
Yeah, it's a Facebook group, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's been great for just getting information about this whole therapy process and what is it and what does it look like for Black people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's so good, so good. I'm actually part of a group, you can message me if you want to get in it, called Melanated and Medicated. And it's a group for people who are, you know, of color, people of color, and predominantly Black folks, and founded by a Black guy, to talk about, you know, living with depression, taking meds for it, not taking meds, getting it on and off meds, you know, navigating through the whole system and the whole world.
Nice.
So,
yeah.
And I think that's just such a great example of people creating space.
Definitely.
That's needed,
and
you know,
the more we have these spaces where people of color, Black people specifically, Black queer people are normalizing the mental health process and the mental health community, the more there's mm-hmm. less stigma about depression and about anxiety.
Definitely, definitely. Especially when, like, you know, Black people are existing in an anxious state, if we're conscious, right? As David was saying yesterday, and it's such a great quote, right, to paraphrase Baldwin,
mm-hmm.
that the reality is the treatment we experience is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, therefore, you know, the subsequent mental health realities that go along with that are robust. And at times, mm-hmm. what's even, you know, of course, exacerbated and, you know, by millions perhaps or so, is the lack of access, underdiagnosing, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I think we talked, what was it, 2016, 2015? Tell me.
Oh, I think it was 2015?
But in the time since we've spoken, I have gotten diagnosed with a kind of weird, rare memory condition called hyperthymesia.
Mm-hmm.
Or highly superior autobiographical memory.
Okay.
So I got I'm in a classification process with the University of California, Irvine.
Mm-hmm.
Waiting to continue on because the way my memories are acquired is visual. So, like, I basically remember everything I see.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't get that diagnosis until 2017. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, you know what I mean? Now, on the other hand, I did have people in my family who had what's, like, people consider photographic memories.
Mm-hmm.
And people just kind of were just like, yeah, just ignore that and try to just get through life and ignore those things.
Yeah.
And I found that that's really difficult to do as a person who lives at intersections of oppression and trauma.
Of course.
You know? So for me personally, you know, that's probably the reason why I'm... if I see racism and I have time to handle it or speak back on it, I'm going to do it, like, every single time.
You know, we need people. We need people to be out in the trenches and to do it. Honestly.
You know, and that's the thing. And we got to take turns sometimes, you know. Sometimes got to sit down, take a minute, you know, for other people. You know, it's just like we have to, you know, trade off or put every bit that we can in because, you know, the forces that fight against us, you know, thrive without our consistent fight back.
Mhm. It's interesting because my dissertation was actually on Black activists and well-being.
Mm.
So this is really, really interesting for me right now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. I mean, it's one of these worlds where, like, I've been writing about it recently in some of my memoir work that I'm trying to finish up. about kind of the faux realities of self-care and trauma resiliency within Black activists and LGBT of color community systems.
Mm-hmm.
And how, like, a lot of people just die early, basically. Like, everybody who's LGBT of color, like, who I've known, they were, you know, they didn't make it past, like, 60 or anything.
Yeah, it's really sad, especially
it's
how we talk about self-care. Because people think self-care is just, like, I'm going to go and, I don't know, buy a Lush bath bomb or something. But self-care is
I want to be like, that's definitely part of it. I don't want to, like, you know, discount that, like, taking care of yourself is cool. But there's not, it's just more to it than just, you know, a classist treat. Okay.
Exactly.
So,
it's not this
so
sort of like capitalist,
real
I have to mm-hmm. buy myself something. Like sometimes
well,
just taking a shower.
The quickness of which Black female, Black women, Black queer, Black non-binary language is therefore weaponized against us
mm-hmm.
is staggering and astounding to me at times.
Oh, definitely.
Right? You know, like if I have a white person ask me about a safe space for themselves someday soon, I'm going to be like, listen. Like, I mean, trying to rock the Buddha's front but most of the time, but like, yo, like, you're like, at this point, what? I'm going to have to throw up a protest sign in your face and just start shouting on that one, right? Like, something has to be said and done, you know, because people, there's basically this appropriation train, there's a culture appropriation train that's happening of culture being kind of maligned and mishandled, misused,
mm-hmm.
and then on top of that, you know, or underneath it, what might you say, is the oppression and trauma that's going along with that for the lived realities of people who experience those things if they're trans women of color.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
right,
definitely.
If they're bi trans women of color who are living in poverty, or if they're people who are coming from any various kind of access. So, you know, for your work and stuff like that, you know, what did you come up to any, like, better suggestions for self-care? Like, you said nap. Was that one of them?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, I personally come from the standpoint that I don't believe that self-care always has to be this capitalistic way that we think about it, like buying yourself
yeah.
something. Like, what does it say for people who are in a different financial state where they don't have the ability to do that? And
right.
for Black people, for Black queer people, because, as you mentioned before, like, our lived experience is one of trauma living in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Self-care needs to be going back to our base needs. Sometimes it is going to be like, did I take a nap today? Did I feed myself today? Did
mm-hmm.
I shower today?
Mm-hmm.
Because we can get so tied into all of the fights that we're doing that we
mm-hmm.
just don't do anything for ourselves, especially when you bring in social media. Like, did I not look at the comments today?
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is the thing. I thought you were going to say, did I, you know, oil up so I didn't stay ashy, but that's just me.
Oh, I mean, if you got the good cocoa butter, that too. That too.
You know, it's like such a, it's one of these things of like, there's so many different things that you can identify that you enjoy in a day, but a lot of times giving yourself the permission to do that thing or spend that time versus do something else, that can be elusive. And I do think it's a really good point about social media because, you know, can't forget anything. So I'm always seeing people on social media going like, I was just like, you should spend more time on other things. But, you know, I'm just like, that's not really fair. But it's like, you know, I think it was recently the NAACP held up a week-long boycott, kind of a little last minute, of Facebook. And I took part in it, and, you know, my screen time, according to my iPhone, went down 19% that week.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was like, ah, okay, because I was still on, like, Twitter and stuff, you know, but
yeah.
Facebook itself is a very, very convenient, popular, great connector. And like anything, you have to design ways to not get sucked in.
Exactly. And it's hard. I mean, it is, I'm definitely someone who's consistently glued to my phone and trying to find ways to not be consistently glued to my phone. It's hard to do, but when you
do
it.
Yeah, have you figured anything out?
Oh, I've had to start, well, trying to implement a, like, no phones in the bed policy. Because I found myself, like, I imagine a lot of people do, wake up first thing in the morning, look, pick up your phone, start scrolling through. And so I'm trying that. I'm, like, trying this right now. So I'll let you know how it goes.
How it goes. Like, does it work as far as a real, you know, it might. It might. It's, you know, it's something that I definitely think about. Trying to adjust and stuff like that, you know, time management. And you must do that all the time because you're, you said you're, like, researching and getting
and
ready
teaching.
To be a clinician and teaching,
yeah.
And you're driving, you know, what is this, an hour each
That's
way?
About an hour, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, the commute itself, honestly, isn't that bad. It's one of the few times where I can just, like, sit in the car, listen to NPR, and just zone out for a little bit, and then, hey, I'm at work. So that's actually
nice.
Welcome.
Right, right, right. And it's almost a form of self-care in some ways if you're able to do something you enjoy.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
You know, or it's definitely not, like, poor care, you know?
Yeah,
like,
exactly,
oh,
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not
so I think
in the car
so good.
Stressed out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because you've done the things you need to make the car ride really successful. You know, you keep yourself going and that, right? That's really good. I'm so glad for you in that regard. I was thinking about you while I was writing about something. I wondered your thought about it. I wanted to come up with something. I did come up with something that I call the Tangela paradox.
Oh my gosh, I have a paradox.
It's not a work. I'm just working on it. I mean, it maybe belongs to somebody else already, and because I don't read, like, nonfiction for the most part at all. So people are like, "What do you know? What do you mean?" And I'm like, "I just read, like, data, like, primary sources, but all the primary sources that, like, as many as I can that have ever existed. So it's a good amount of knowledge that I have. And one of the things that I was looking at was, you know, some of the statements that you had made prior as far as bisexual people's feelings of acceptance, you know, inside of the LGBT community is something you've written about and spoken on. And it's quoted in a great Daily Beast article written by pretty much my favorite writer at this point, I guess, Samantha Allen. I really do like her. She's great. She's an amazing ally to Black Lives, and she's, like, one of the few, like, white writers I've seen give a shit or anything about black people. So there's that. But yeah, and an amazing, you know, trans writer as well, and just, you know, a super great ally to bi communities. And she wrote that piece, right? What's it called? Shut Out of the LGBT Club or something?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. For the
that
Daily
was a great
Beast.
One.
Mm-hmm. So in that, you know, you kind of go into this, you went into this idea that I was thinking of. It's like kind of like a paradox, right? Where people basically inside of minority communities, whether that be the bisexual community inside the LGBT community, or whether that be like black women inside of black communities, or black bisexual women inside of black women communities, we feel the dissonance or difficulty of, like, communication failures or microaggressions or even macroaggressions at, like, a higher rate or with more intensity.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Definitely.
So and I thought it was, like, a paradox because it has to be resolved, right, by kind of acknowledging that intersectionality, right, that this is – the intersectionality is essentially – the pathway by which shit gets fucked up, guys. Like, not like a fun thing. Okay.
That's a great way to put it.
that's the best way. Like, that's, I cannot keep dealing with this whole, like, intersectionality. I'm like, did you, what? It's like, I'm sorry, I get really upset. So, because people, they're confused on it. They don't understand. It's like, it's about adding difficulties and addressing that, right? And understanding that as things intersect, the difficulties may become even more erased and harder to tease out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so therefore, if we don't kind of acknowledge those Tangela paradoxes, which in bi communities, to me, that looks like people kind of acknowledging tension, but not necessarily falling completely for, like, that's what we have to spend all of our time on, right?
Yeah.
And the way I would advocate on that is that every instance of bi erasure isn't an instance that we need to fight back on, right?
Yes, definitely. You have to choose your battles.
If it's like, this is like, you guys keep doing this, what is going on? Okay. You know, but, you know, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, this is my advocacy. I just, like, write people about, the fact that they said gay and lesbian, and, you know, that's what I do. And I'm like, well, that's super effective. Thanks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, though, as a black, bisexual, queer, intersex woman, that's not something that's actually really effective for me, right? The outcome might be that, like, great, this white bisexual who opens up their newspaper now gets to see themselves, but what does that mean for me?
Yeah.
I don't have no newspaper, okay? Like, you know, I might not have a house, I might not have this, I might not have that, right? So people's kind of misunderstanding, I think, sometimes about intersectionality, and then also the experience specifically of black people in this country, I think is very limited, right? Mm-hmm. I tell people that, I've been telling people that a lot, that, you know, I don't really see that many black people and white people know each other. I had to unfriend a whole bunch of white bisexuals, just let them know, I really don't know you. Just kidding. But I was mostly because I got hacked by Russia, so it was really just Russians everywhere. But because I was like, oh my God. But it was also one of these things where I was like, wow, I am surrounded by white people, and I'm very thankful for the fans, and that's why, you know, I welcome people to my Facebook fan page, which has 134,000 followers and counting, and it's much more of a global experience. And I'm like telling people, like, come over here and, like, meet somebody from, like, this other country who's going to be like, I can't be queer like you, but here's my experience, you know? And that's, like, just as valid a way to be queer, to be gay, to be bi. And a lot of times I'm not going to go down their throat, so to speak, about missing the B word in their, you know, in their plea, in their cry to be seen, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's this interesting ability to, like, kind of understand that in parts there's been a great deal, I think, of white supremacy inside of bisexual communities with the focus on surrounding bisexual erasure as a whole, right, instead of the focus on bisexual intersectionality, right? Getting white people invested in black and brown lives, right? Getting white people, more white people on the front lines, right? We do have a number of white allies and accomplices who do great stuff, who are doing as best they can, but I'm not, that's not really the forefront, right? And the way I see that is, you know, when people are putting out news stories that are like, oh, here's another news story about bisexual erasure. And it's like, okay, there's, like, kids in cages and stuff. Like, sorry, like, just putting it out there. Like, what's going on? Like, you know, like, can we go a little deeper, right? Like, you know, like, we have, you know, bisexual disabled advocates doing amazing work right now. We have bi and pan trans advocates trying to increase the amount of asylum seekers that are, you know, being successfully able to enter into this country. You know what I'm saying? Like, we have so many people doing stuff, but it seems sometimes that kind of paradox, I don't know, that's the thing I'm working through a little bit. I wonder if you had thoughts on it as far as, like, kind of how that feeling basically decreases feelings of self-efficacy or the feeling that you can stay in this fight, right? Yeah. Even if you're not, you know, running it, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to choose your battles in terms of, like, what can I, like, mentally and emotionally handle right now, you know? And sometimes going after, I don't want to say the lowest hanging fruit, but sometimes going after something that's a little bit less complex might be the easiest route for people. And at the same time, I think people go for things that are less complex, things that don't have intersectionality in it, because this country has a hard time talking and thinking and having a relationship with race. So a lot of times it's easier to just talk about bi erasure as opposed to talking about bisexual people of color and health disparities and why are there, like, actual health disparities for bisexual people of color. It's easier to talk about certain things than other things, for better or worse, you know. But, yeah, I do agree. There's a lot more going on. But, you know, we're talking about a community, especially for bi people of color, where it's a marginalized community that has a marginalized status. So it's a community that's marginalized already within a marginalized community, and then you add race on it, it's another marginalized status, and it can get tricky as to figure out where you should sort of, what battle you should fight today. You know, should I fight the battle to be seen today, or should I fight the battle that you can see all of this other stuff that I'm doing. But how can you see all of this other great things that I'm doing if you can't even see me as a bi person? Like, how can you see that there's great bi and pan advocates for immigration? How can you see any of that if you just see us as lesbian and gay people? Mm-hmm. A little bit different, mm-hmm. You know?
No. It was interesting yesterday. David had said to me, you know, and you have heard this most of my life, I'm sure you have as well. He said, you know, when I go into spaces, especially LGBT spaces, they frequently kind of neglect that, you know, I enter that room as a black person, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what people see first.
Cool.
And, you know, and that's true. It's absolutely true. And at the same time, you know, in my head, I wanted to joke to myself, and I did, but not then, that, you know, that's true, but I'm still invisible.
Of course.
I enter into a room as a black person, and I might even have a t-shirt that says bisexual on, I might have a button, but...
It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what do I really mean by that, right? I mean that when I self-disclose my bisexuality in public to people, the response that I will receive will be sexual harassment, it will be sexual violence, it will be mm-hmm. microaggression, it'll be a diminishment, some sort of nasty comment, raised eyebrow. I really want to get like a Google Glasses thing and like, you know, do an experiment where people, you know, I just walk through life and I go, I'm bisexual, and I like record the faces, you know? Because it's like a whole thing. Like the face. Like,
it is.
And it's thing. It's like, you know. I used to say I'm a bisexual activist, and I used to get the weirdest things. Like lesbians would be like, oh, really?
Well, I'm
a lesbian, honey. And I'd be like, what does that mean? Why are you a lesbian, honey? Like, does that even, like, honey, like, literally? No, not honey, literally.
Like, why is there so much anger about it? And I definitely have experienced that being in... being in LGBT spaces, like, one, not really feeling comfortable in certain spaces because I'm a black person,
mm-hmm.
and not really feeling comfortable in white LGBT spaces, and there's a few of them.
I mean, and they do it to us all the time. Like, I'm about to go someplace, I'm about to go to Harvard
mm-hmm.
next month and speak at their LGBT conference.
Well,
God bless them.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's one of the first times I've been on a panel talking about growing up and kind of being closeted about being intersex most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only been the last couple of years that I've kind of come out about that and been more discussing it, because in part it's like a history of violence and trauma.
Okay.
That I'm like, let's do talk about reparative rape. I'll raise my hand. So I've got to have laughs about it, right? So, you know, but the thing that's going to be interesting is that my panel about, you know, kind of being black intersex with another black intersex rock star, Sean Seyfawol, is
mm-hmm.
at the same time as a panel with Darnell Moore.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and Darnell Moore and I both probably, like, have been associated with the Black Lives Matter movement and pretty much everybody else on that whole, like, list of, like, speakers, you know.
Yeah,
as far
yeah.
as, like, somebody's people who have been associated with various chapters or, you know, help start stuff or popularize things or what's going on. So, and then also kind of operating in similar LGBT black space, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, why do they, like, do that, you know what I'm saying? Because it's like the conference, you know, they're not really paying us a lot to be there, right? So, you know, we go there and we get up there and we get something for being at a Harvard conference. But we don't get to hear our own people speak because they're at the same time as us. So it kind of kind of proves the theory that it's not really about us, right? We're a performance monkey for them, you know. No offense. I'm still going to show up and look pretty, you know. But but it's just one of these things that I notice and I'll bring up, and I've already brought up to Darnell and to other people who are on those panels who I know and say, hey, I'm really sorry that we can't, you know, see each other. I would love to hear your presentation, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a black LGBT person, it'd be great to hear this amazing black gay speaker who's a best-selling book out, literally on the New York Times bestseller charts. Like, he's amazing. Everybody should check him out. He's on mic. He's a video show. Anyway, I'm just putting it out there. Like, it would be, I would like to see him. But, like, people, they don't think about that. They're like, oh, no, you guys are similar. So, you know, we'll have you on different things. And, like, you know, that way everybody gets something, right? So it becomes less about
what's strategically better for our movements, right?
Mm-hmm.
And more about what kind of fits a schedule, which I get. I really do want to get and be like, I totally understand why it happens. But I'm going to propose to the schedulers in the future that they, you know, think about shorter sessions.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
that allow
the
for
message,
everybody to go to every session.
Yeah, because the message is that you have to pick one black queer LGBT experience because they're all the same. Like, that's the unconscious message that you're getting there.
Oh, and it's like there's going to be probably four people per person, but anywho, like, you know what I mean? It's one of these things of it's not going to be you will provide choice, and everybody, mm-hmm. we get to, you know, be there, and it's a great honor and privilege to speak at Harvard, of course, so thank you so much again, Harvard. But I look at you, side eye, but I still think, and this is not just a Harvard thing, I've seen this all the time. Right,
oh,
like it's just like every single conference, like, you know, and the things that I've seen that people do have been really innovative. There was a really great black organizer I ran into, a black straight organizer who's very affirming of black LGBT people named Khalid Kamau, and I think he's a councilman in South Fulton, Georgia. And I ran into him at Netroots Nation, where I was again had my anti-blackness training, how don't fear the black activist, how to communicate without anti-blackness is my new training. And it was put up against black people, and he came to me and he was like, hey, do you mind if we reorganize your time? And we're going to have somebody stand outside your space, and they're going to tell people that you've been reorganized on behalf of blackness. And I was like, oh, of course. This sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Blackness? Blackness is here. Thank you. It's amazing. You know, it was like one of the first times that somebody else had that thought and then was like, let's take care of this. We know each other. We don't need to have this happen.
Yeah.
You know? But, of course, let me just be real with you. The Tangela paradox was there, present and apparent, right? Because it all worked out until what? There was a black trans panel and a black female panel at the same time. And do you know what? We couldn't figure it out at that point.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's one of these things where the intersectionality, it's like a very slowly closing tunnel. You know? Sometimes it's like we have to keep punching that wall to open it up and open that space, right? To create that space for people to be seen, to people to have space, and also to be open about it. Be like, yeah, that was a really great thing until it broke.
Yeah.
And why? Because it's always going to break. So no offense, like it was an awesome idea, but but we have to keep punching, you know, not get upset too, which I think is very difficult to kind of navigate. Well, I think being invigorated by the youth is helping me.
Definitely.
Yeah, you get that. You get the access all day. Like, it's a jolt to your arm, right? Do you feel like that a little bit?
Oh, I definitely feel like that. I mean, it's great, and I'm consistently trying to find new ways to be on my toes.
Mm-hmm. There's so much information that they have access to within an age group, and they're very, I feel, keen to be engaged in conversations with people that are past beyond their generation, which is different from where I was as a young person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, distrustful of older people, I think I was as a younger person.
Yeah, I probably was. And the language is evolving, and it's evolving so quick among younger people that it's great to see, like, how are they identifying, how are they using these words, what words are they using, and why?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. No, I definitely think that's something that we're seeing a lot of evidence of change on, you know, especially I'm in a pansexual pride Facebook group. And, you know, it's got like 15,000 members or something like this. And over the years, a number of bi activists have gotten themselves banned from it. But I got to stay. and I always say it's because, like, I'm really pretty chill about it. You know what I mean? When it comes to people saying, oh, this means this. I'm like, well, actually, it doesn't. But I'm usually not going to, like, kill you for saying that, so to speak, because so many people think that. Right?
Yeah,
it's a systemic issue, right?
Yeah.
In the sense that who thinks this most? People who have access to privilege and education and social theory. Who doesn't think this most? People who are of color, people who identify as bisexual, which black people do at twice the rate of white people, according to studies in the last 5 years, like repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's one of these things of like we have to kind of identify that, you know, poor folks, people who don't have access to things, they just call themselves whatever they want to call themselves, right? And why should we care anything, right? Other than, do you feel like you're a part of our history, our culture, our community? Yes, cool. There's by twas, and there's also no labels. Or whatever you want. You can just be Chris. The label Chris, you know?
Do you feel like you're part of the community? Are you getting support? That should be what matters most. But there's a lot of people trying to make this division. And
there's a lot of hurt. I mean, there's a lot of hurt, right? And I think that's where it comes from. And I think that you know, there's been people, and I just want to, like, put it out there. They could have just been, like, the same five fansexuals going around saying this. Not everybody. So, you know, it's just one of these things where it has been a miss. You know, it came up earlier this year. I don't know if you saw this conversation with the amazing, most talented actress, India Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking and kind of mentioned something about binaries, and Sada Ramirez was in the conversation and tagged me into it and was like, you know, Faith, you've talked to me about this. And I was like, I totally have. But I'm always, like, so wanting to be sensitive to women of color, and trans women of color particularly, right, or intersex or non-binary people. I'm like, yo, like, FYI, people have other things going on than dictionaries.
Yeah.
Which ultimately is the issue. It's definitely, that's the issue. If we wanted to all focus on the dictionaries and calling Merriam-Webster up every day, if anybody wants to DM me, I'll send you their phone number. You know, because I've talked to them repeatedly. They refuse to make the changes we've requested.
Please send me that number. I will try to contact them as well.
I'm real. Like, we should really just put all the researchers on it, because it's ridiculous. Because they say, honestly, they say it's about science. They're like, in science, the word bisexual is used or utilized this way. I'm like, we have data that says people use this data. Like, we use this identity.
That doesn't make sense, because in science, bisexual means, like, frogs or squids who can literally change their biological sex. And so the way that people use it is not that. So that doesn't make sense.
No, that's pretty much, and I was like, so basically you're saying that the definition of, like, people who live on intersex spectrum... like bisexual, which is basically like, are you in 1860? Like, and like also using a stethoscope that's like really large? Like, I don't, like.
That's the thing about definitions. I mean, I'm definitely personally of the mindset of you define and identify however you define and identify.
Mm-hmm.
You do you, I do me. If we meet in the middle, great. If not, we're doing the things for ourselves, right? But I just don't, and I recognize that there is some trauma around this whole, you know, by definition argument that people have experienced. I recognize and see that trauma. And at the same time, I just don't quite understand the purpose of, like, defining yourself in opposition to someone else.
Yeah, and I don't think it is. You know, one of the best things I've ever known is that I met my first pansexual in 1998.
No.
I was introduced, amazing person named Finnegan, mm-hmm. who is the son of Cynthia Connors, who's a very respected bisexual advocate who helps with NYABN, the New York Area Bisexual mm-hmm. Network. And so he actually said, you should meet my mom. Where, you know, she's on LiveJournal, too. And I was like, oh, yeah, she's on LiveJournal, huh? So, because I thought that was interesting that his mom was on LiveJournal. And it turns out she's, like, everywhere on the internet, you know, trying to advocate. She's a peer of Brenda Howard's, other people. And she's like, yo, like, trying to get people educated about bisexuality. But her kid was pansexual, right? Mm-hmm. And he was like, the reason I'm pansexual for me is that, for me, it's really expansive. It's about me having a lover on every continent. It's about me never seeing any gender. It's about me living my whole life without any boundaries. And for my mom, she's just like, I don't care what kind of person I end up with sexually or romantically, which is cool. But for me, this is about expanding and pushing past mm-hmm. capacities. And I thought that was I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense to me. You know, it's like people who are like, I'm cool with what's in bed versus people who are like, fuck beds, rip this shit up. Right?
Yeah, so, no, that's great. That is amazing. You know, and I've had
That's a different way to approach it, but I think supremacy came in, and then you add in that Google block, the Google block really disrupted a lot between 09 and 14 because you see it spike, right? You see the use of pansexuals spike during that time, and people start to utilize even things that bisexuals have said for decades, like hearts, not parts. That's like a bi thing. A what? Like somebody came up with that in the 60s or something. You know, so it's one of these things where people are reinterpreting it and then labeling it with something that they perceive won't elicit harm and supports trans people. Unfortunately, bi trans people, which represent, what, 30% of some of the data that we've seen nationally, they get left behind by those people.
Yeah, like there are bi and non-binary trans people. I've had people in my own life who have come to me knowing that I'm an out bi advocate and activist, wanting to have this conversation / argument. Like I said, I'm really of the mindset of I don't care how you identify or you do you do you, I do me, right? That's my like mantra for life. But I've had people like come to me and sort of say that my identity is oppressive because of this, right?
And
it's been interesting because my response is always, I have a non-binary partner. What are you talking about? It's that. And it's like, that's, you're not actually asking how I define bisexuality for myself. And a few months ago, I like started doing a little bit of the hashtag, like ask a bi person. Because people aren't talking. There's just all of these assumptions that there's something negative and harmful. And like I said, like I definitely acknowledge that there has been harm done, perceived and real, there has been harm done, but there's this perception that in and of itself, bisexuality is inherently damaging, but people aren't actually talking to people who identify as bi. Like if you ask me, like how do I identify my bisexuality, I'll say that it means that I have the propensity to be attracted to similar and different genders, right? So my non-binary partner is a different gender.
Yeah, no, I totally, and it's a funny thing that you mentioned that because I was on the internet, and I believe I have screenshots that may evidence this, at least the message archive, where that definition that you spoke just now, I and a number of activists helped design.
Yeah.
Because it was a direct response to the binarism accusation that was kind of everywhere on the internet. And it happened pretty much between 07 and 09. The Pan Pride flag is created in 07 by a person who now identifies as bisexual. It doesn't really want to be found or spoken to by anybody about the creation of the flag, from my understanding. Yeah, they've had such a difficult time because they basically wanted to make it a new thing that would go along with the bi community. So the Pan Pride flag uses the same pink as the bi pride flag on purpose, and uses the other colors from the rainbow pride flag on purpose as well. And so it was very much like, hey, I want to have this contribution to be part of community, and then they saw it get used and, you know, utilized and weaponized. But a lot of times I tell people that if you're not actually kind of spending time in pan space, you won't realize that that's really not representative of the pan community.
Yeah.
They're not going around just like going, bah! It's just not happening, right? So kind of what's happening instead is microaggressions and ways to harm bisexuals have been identified, and this is one of them, right? Mm-hmm. So people who have internalized biphobia, who are struggling with their own bisexuality, might bring this up. People who are, you know, biphobic already and have a latent issue surrounding bisexuality or disdain or disregard for it on a regular basis will definitely bring this up, right? It's not an accident to me, like, when it gets brought up. It's not like a, ooh, I brought up a sensitive topic. It's like, no, you brought up this thing that, like, is a sensitive thing for people because it's harmful and it's based off of a really wrong misconception, which is that bisexuality exists as an attraction to men and women at the same time, right? If you don't think that, then you won't think it's binary.
Yeah.
Right? Well, like if you just go gender, like, it's all good. Then you go, oh.
And then there's people who identify both as bi and pan. Like,
oh, yeah.
Blowing your mind right now. There are people, you know.
I mean, I used to do it more. I would say at this point I'm just all the letters, you know, but it's like this thing of like, you know, BPFQMNOP was the 8-letter device I made to help me remember the top, you know.
Oh, nice.
The data we have says most people identify as bi, pan, fluid, queer, no labels, which is a space in my head, multisexual, non-monosexual, omnisexual, polyasexual.
Yeah, I mean, so, honestly, most of the data about the LGBT community that's just been looking at numbers has mm-hmm. said that bisexuals account for the vast majority of the LGBT community, and I'm sure, I mean, this has been like scientific data that probably hasn't expounded the sexual orientations past just LGB, but I'm sure if they like looked into that bisexual category, there's going to be multiples within that.
Yeah, well, I think one of the interesting things, that's one of the things I think it's so important to reframe conversations surrounding pan people as also conversations about minorities within minorities, right? So again, the Tangela paradox becomes like a really helpful tool to tease that out. You know,
I really love this Tangela paradox, by the way.
I'm so glad. So it's like one of these things where, I mean, this is supposed to be in my book, so yeah, I'll let you know. Somebody will contact you to fact check that you like it. So thank you for agreeing. But yeah, no, it's one of these things where I think that our data is pretty clear. We have the 2014 bisexual youth study by the HRC and Binet USA and BOP and BRC were all engaged with that report. And then subsequent studies have also suggested similar data that even between the ages of 13 and 18, between the ages of 18 and 21, the vast majority of young people are identifying as bisexual, right? And then within the bi category, within that majority number, there is a smaller minority that are identifying as pansexual. So, because people say, well, it's just a younger thing, you know, it's what the kids are doing. I'm like, no.
No.
It's what the media representation of youth that you have access to or choose to, you know, engage with, you know, provides to you. Right, but if you're in, you know, a housing insecure shelter with a whole bunch of LGBT youth, they're gonna be like, I'm bisexual. So, you know, and they're gonna know. They're gonna be like, yeah, she's pansexual. I'm cool with her being pan. We're cool. But they don't have any of that conversation. Why? Because they're also hungry. They're looking for food tonight. Right. A lot of people are not engaged in that conversation in the same privileged way.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I think it's one of these things that if we start to go, yo, when it comes to pan people, here's what we know. Right. Pan people report are more likely to identify with a gender that is not quote unquote binary, right? So they're more likely to be transgender as people, right? Or in the sense that it's not, and that's why I tell people, it's not that there are no bi trans people, is that many pan people are trans. Right? So, you know, so if you just kind of like go that way, then you go, oh, it just means more bi pan people. I go, exactly, more of us to love. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's more important to just like figure out, like we all operate within these systems, right? To figure out like why are there these systems of oppression? Like why, what has happened to cause this trauma and cause this pain? For people who identify as pan, people who identify as bi, people who identify as both, like what's happened to cause these systems? I mean, these this pain and oppression, and how can we work to tear down those systems and heal?
Yeah,
that should be most important.
I think a lot of it does have to do with that uplifting and amplification, right? Because what we see is anytime we start to talk about issues, they get better, mm-hmm. right? You know, so we see, you know, actual, you know, data reflects that with intervention, trans kids don't harm themselves as often, right? What does that intervention look like? People saying that they're okay and awesome and beautiful and amazing because they are, right? So when we see that data, we go, yes, let's do this because people said it worked out and we have that, right? We don't necessarily have that for bi youth yet. We don't have that for youth of color, yeah. Right? You know, HRC did a study recently. I don't know if you saw it on black LGBT youth.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked a lot of questions that I found fascinating. Yesterday when I spoke with David Johns, I asked, you know, if he was engaged in the consortium surrounding it. He said, you know, a little bit. There was some basis to get the word out and that type of thing. But as far as the study design, not so much. right? So what we see a lot of times is questions that I feel are loaded, almost replicating a new type of dog whistle, but coming from a white, gay, cis experience. So the headline reads, "More Black Families Disparage Black Queer Youth," right? And I'm like, thanks, HRC. Happy Black History Month to you as well.
Yeah, right? This idea that black people and black communities are inherently homophobic is damaging. It is damaging, and it's not helpful, it's inaccurate.
Because it doesn't actually indicate a lot of different things, right? Somebody says, well, what do you mean, Faith? I go, okay, let me just keep it real with you, right? Many black children will experience disparagement in their home, period, point, freaking blank. So if you want to ask questions about what black families are struggling with to do effective parenting while managing depression, anxiety, rage, and grief with constantly being inundated with anti-blackness, racism, and the threat of death, then we could talk. You know, we could talk.
You can't look at one and completely disavow it of, like, we're in this system of racism that is traumatic. Mm-hmm. Like, that's important, and you have to hold that at the forefront of any conversation you're going to have.
So it becomes a difficult proposition, therefore, to draw out black LGBT data without teasing out at the same time black cis straight data, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. To not indicate, be like, oh, well, here's what black children are experiencing. I'm like, I didn't hear nothing about how many black children have black fathers in the home. I didn't see shit about that in your report. Just checking. Because that's a conversation that would happen in a black family and black community, right? If we were having this conversation in Ebony Magazine, it would be like a pros versus cons. I'm not going to lie to you. Where people are still having conversations and very much struggling to say, should LGBT people have the same access and space? But I would argue that that's in part because of the great harm that white LGBT America rains down on black people as a whole.
Of course, of course.
Whether that's the theft of civil rights language and movement work, whether that's the exclusion of black people from diversity councils and diversity experiences that literally are the ones that we would be most affected by, right?
Or even if it's just this idea that sort of like trickle-down human rights and social justice is going to happen.
I'm so over it.
We should have learned that trickle-down economics doesn't happen, so trickle-down rights and social justice doesn't happen. And, like, no. I say this knowing that I'm a bi person who, you know, is, I mean, fingers crossed, going to be married sometime soon. You know, we'll talk about that later.
Hey, congrats.
Thanks. And at the same time, I don't think that marriage is the most important thing. I'm not going to enter any conversation about what's important for LGBT people, starting with marriage, knowing that black trans women are being massacred at an alarming rate. Like, black kids are homeless. Why? Like, marriage means very little when the lives of black and brown queer people are diminishing.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that is the most powerful opportunity for white bisexuals is that the data for white bi people is like pretty much the one group of white group people who is closest to black folks. that's pretty much why I've been chilling here, guys. No, but, like, really, a lot of people impoverished, right? 34% to 38% of the, you know, the bi community has faced poverty, right? And we know that a smaller percentage of that number is black, right? The vast majority of that number is white, right? So those are white people who are poor. Those are white people who are broke, right? And that's definitely been the vast majority of the organizers that I've organized with. Now, organizers I've traveled with, you know, it's more, they're the ones who have the money, right? So it's one of these things where you have to, you know, kind of start to have bigger conversations about wealth disclosure and classism and how that intersects, right, for communities of color and why that uniquely disprivileges black and brown people who, you know, don't have those wealth backgrounds, who don't have an uncle to buy or owe, you know, money. So, I mean, literally the only reason why I was able to go to first, you know, stand at the White House, you know, behind President Obama when he signed that executive order, was one of our board members, like, took out money on a credit card so I could go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Thank you, Gary North. So because I, you know, I got an invite and I just immediately turned it down. I was like, oh yeah, I can't make that. Like, you know, like, and people are like, what do you mean you can't make that? I was like, yeah, no, they wanted me to like stand with them. I mean, it seems cool and stuff, but there's no way I can afford that, right? So it's just one of these things that didn't seem like I could do it, but it was, you know, deemed by my board to be something that was beneficial to our organization and worth, you know, contributing to. And we raised the money to pay it off and we're able to do that. But it was one of these things where I did not have that in my family, right?
Yeah.
I did not have that in my, like, just go ahead, get it, you know? And I might have it from, you know, some Christian conservative family members I might have. They say, well, you could come and do that faith. But, you know, they want me to go to church right after with them, and I'm not going. So, you know, I mean, it's one of these trade-offs that a lot of people have to make to try to operate within their lives. And so many bisexual people know that, what that is to do it. But a lot of times they're not necessarily going, oh, what would this be like if I was also black? What would it be like if I was also disabled, right? Where is that and or coming in, mm-hmm. right? That they start to go, okay, my experience, you know, I have access to something, so what am I doing, right? What am I doing to change the image, you know, for black people, right? So, you know, I always say to white people who are interested in learning more about racial justice in this country, there's a great organization called Showing Up for Racial Justice. That's yeah. their website, showingupforracialjustice.org. They used to have a ED who was a queer woman. I think that their new ED is a queer affirming, at the very least, if not queer themselves again, because they love LGBT people in the organization. They're very closely affiliated with the UU church as well, in the sense that a lot of times there are events happening in UU churches or in sometimes in synagogues or Jewish community spaces, and they're very interfaith-oriented. So I think that's a great resource that we'll also make sure to provide a link to, which is Showing Up for Racial Justice. You can put your zip code in and find a group in your area that would allow you to learn more about racial justice and show up for black and brown people who are organizing in their spaces. Any other resources that you might recommend for our bi-cast audience that might help them learn more? We're going to give them that link about the from Samantha Allen's Daily Beast article, of course, but
yeah.
maybe we can share with them. Do you have a page yet, a Facebook page or something where people can follow your great exploits and adventures?
I am on Twitter. I have to be a little bit more active, so I will say that it's probably kind of a boring Twitter page, but I am on Twitter. It's at Dr. Tangi, so dr.tangi.
Perfect. Love it. That sounds good, and we will make sure we get that in there, too. All right,
I think that's my Instagram as well, yeah.
Oh, cool. Definitely. That sounds amazing. Elizabeth, I think we're kind of probably pushing towards the end of our time again.
Okay. Thank you so much, Faith Cheltenham, for hosting Dr. Tangela Roberts with us today. Thank you, Dr. Tangela. It was a great episode. I've learned a lot. Like Faith said, we'll have links and all sorts of pages and stuff for you to read after when we get this posted on our blog. Great episode. Thank you again. You are not wrong. You are not broken. And you are not alone. You are a human being. You are bisexual. And you have community. Bye.
Bye.
If you teach bird to sing, she gonna learn to fly. If you let her sing, she gonna fly. If you let her sing, she gonna fly away. If you teach bird to sing,
transcription services provided by Bind's Transcript and Typing Services. Just say it, and we'll type it. As leaders in the transcription industry, it's their vision to help business owners reach their project goals for their organization or company by transcribing or providing general office support. They're transcribing what I'm saying right now. Their staff is readily available to assist. Order now and get up to 20% off of your first assignment. Regularly 99 cents a minute, celebrating 11 years in business. And thank you, Fran Bynes, for your volunteer activism. Find them at www.binestranscriptions.com.
The views expressed on the Bycast do not necessarily represent those of Bynet USA or the Bycast crew.
Nip it back.